Hi, I'm Deborah Holchip, editor of Michigan Today. In this episode of Listen in Michigan, my guest is Lauren Chandevel, a senior in the Ford School of Public Policy, who uploaded a Google document titled Being Not Rich at U of M last year to aid low-income students seeking housing, jobs, and internships, not to mention cheap eats and free happy hours. Since creating the open-access crowdsourced document last year, it has grown to more than 100 pages, just full of links, and hundreds of students, faculty, and alumni have contributed practical tips to surviving college on a low income, from how to buy or repair a laptop to managing debt, receiving food assistance, and finding affordable books. The college admissions scandal, splashed across the headlines of late, has focused on the nation's wealthy parents basically buying their kids' way into our elite institutions. But Lauren says the real admissions scandal is not about bribes and cheating, but about the ways in which wealth tips the scales in education from day one. As a low-income student herself, she decided to create some balance at U of M. She wanted to help other low-income students navigate this hidden curriculum of unwritten campus norms, values, and expectations. In a recent conversation piece, in fact, U of M Flint Chancellor Susan Borrego wrote that too often the literature about low-income students is deficit-based. That is, talking about what low-income students need to overcome. Instead, she noticed we should focus on the assets they deliver. Critical consciousness, resilience, brilliance. I think after you listen to this episode, you'll agree that Lauren Chandevel delivered all of those assets and more at Michigan. Here's Lauren.
A lot of these kids on campus think that, you know, their status here or their the fact that they're here is purely the result of hard work. And they can sort of tout that over low-income students who already feel sort of alienated and left out and like they don't belong here. And it's not intentional, but, you know, I think it's a societal thing where we attribute wealth to merit and, like, poverty to personal deficiency. You know, poor people are seen as being less than. And it's no different on campus where you have very high-income students who have had a lot of privileges saying, oh, but I worked so hard and it was like all the result of my hard work. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm here. That's why I deserve to be here. And a lot of the times that results in pointing the fingers at low-income students and students of color and students who are on this campus who are deemed quote-unquote affirmative action cases and are made to feel like they don't belong here when they've actually worked really, really hard and haven't had those advantages. I remember when I was a freshman and talking to so many of my low-income friends who were first arriving on this campus, they didn't know why they felt so left out and alienated. Like, they didn't realize that it was their socioeconomic background. They got here and they were like, everyone's so different from me. You know, they've had this really great education. They go on all these fancy trips and can afford all these fancy things. And I just don't know why I feel so left out. And so being able to name that and say, like, no, it's like actually disparate class backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And like there's a reason for that, and that's not something that you should be ashamed of, is something that's really important for those students. I'm of the opinion, like being a low-income student myself, that low-income students work so hard to get into elite colleges because you have so many students on, I can speak for this campus, but I know that it's the case on other campuses as well, where kind of their entire lives they've been goaded in the direction of higher education. Either their parents were alums or they went to a really good high mm-hmm. school that had great college counseling mm-hmm. and the counselors were telling them that they can go to these elite places, whereas low-income students haven't had that experience growing up. And so they really pushed hard to get here, sometimes without help from anyone. So I take great pride in being a low-income student and knowing that a lot of my hard work was hard work, right? Not to undermine the hard work of high-income mm-hmm. students, but I feel like there isn't much acknowledgement that goes toward the privileges that some students have because the education system in America is so unequal.
Yeah.
So I've really adopted the term low-income and working class as a point of pride for me, and I hope that others can do the same.
Have you found that having created this guide and distributed it and it has become a thing, has that helped kind of a little more understanding on campus? Like, do you feel a shift has been made, or is it just same as ever, but there's more information out there now for low-income people?
I definitely feel a shift. It started with the guide, and that's when more affordability issues started to be adopted by CSG. So I chair their affordability task force, and hopefully there will be a commission next year. There's been a lot of talk about affordability in general, but then there's also, and I don't know if you know about this other project that I helped get off the ground, but my friend and I helped create a minor in class and inequality studies in the Women's Studies Department.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thank
wow.
you. It passed in January, and
good
it's
for you.
Like the first of its kind in the country. And so that's like
oh
a way
God.
For students to study social class in conjunction with race and gender and sexuality and really learn about how it impacts outcomes
mm-hmm.
And get a better understanding about what social class is and how it may have affected them. So all of those conversations have sort of happened while I've been here, which has been great.
So often we get so caught up in diversity as being a racial thing or a religious thing. We forget. And it's only recently that we've been really reminded it's economic as well.
You know, two people who, you know, look the same or have similar like racial or ethnic backgrounds
mm-hmm.
can still have very different experiences in the world because of their class background. And so I think, you know, adding that
mm-hmm.
analysis to it lets people sort of figure out, you know, who they are and what their identity is and where they stand and what their position is in the world. And
yeah.
it can be very helpful.
What possessed you to want, like, why don't you tell me a little bit about your backstory? I don't know a whole lot about it, if you want.
Yeah, so I grew up in Warren, Michigan, which I don't know if you're a native Michigander.
Yes,
but,
I am.
Yeah,
my college roommate is from Warren.
Really?
one of my besties ever.
I have never met another person from Warren on this campus, and it is the third largest city in the state.
You
which
are
is
kidding.
Absurd. I've met so many Bloomfields and Birminghams and Grosse Pointes, but no Warrens. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's where I'm from. And neither of my parents have 4-year degrees. My mom has an associate's in secretarial science, and my dad, you know, never went to college. So growing up was kind of tough because my dad was the only one with a job. My mom stayed home to take care of my brother and I, and we were living like pretty close to the poverty line. And I was in the Warrenwood school system for most of my K through 12 career up until my freshman year of high school, after which I begged my parents to let me transfer to a school about 20 minutes away in Oakland County, which is like a significantly wealthier county. And so for 3 years, I commuted to that school. There was a lot of socioeconomic and racial diversity there because it pulled from a lot of different communities. And in particular, there was like an upper middle class community that was that went to that school and did a lot of the AP classes and
okay.
the extracurriculars and went to the good colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And so me not really understanding class dynamics, I immediately, you know, went to that school and entered all the AP classes, started doing extracurriculars without really thinking about how I'm different from my peers. And I made friends with a lot of people there, and I had a really great experience. But I think that's when I sort of started to have some class consciousness, because I was like, why is this school so much better than the school that I transferred from? You know, not just resource-wise, but also like in terms of people's attitude about the students. Like, people genuinely believe that these students could accomplish great things, whereas at the school that I had transferred from, it was just like, oh, if you don't get into college, which if you do get into college, it like probably won't be a place like Michigan. But if you don't, then you'll go to trade school, or you'll go to community college, or you'll
mm-hmm.
have kids, or you'll drop out. You know, that was sort of par for the course. But it was different there. And so it was also a feeder school to Michigan. So I followed about 30 of my peers for my graduating class here. And that's when all those class dynamics were sort of amplified.
Well, what advice do you have for parents who would be sending their kids here?
I would say just keep reminding them that they deserve to be here just as much as anyone else, especially in those moments where they feel like they don't belong or that this place wasn't built for them. Just keep being a support system for them.
Well, and what's beautiful is that guide was built for them. Have you done any kind of informal market research, I guess, to see how people are using it and what they're getting out of it?
I think there's this assumption that if we don't have money on campus, we're just not spending it wisely. And that's just not the case. A lot of low-income students work multiple jobs, or, you know, they live off campus, and so it's hard for them to commute over here, and it gets expensive. And so the huge debate in Ann Arbor is the affordable housing debate. There's a section in there that sort of rates landlords, which was pretty cool in a good way, because it's hard for students to figure out if a landlord is a good landlord,
mm-hmm.
and you can only really know from word of mouth, and usually you're scrambling to find a place, and it's getting late in the semester, and you will take anything at that point.
Yeah.
So until you have to buy 8 mouse traps for your kitchen, which I had to do last semester. You haven't lived as a college student. I think one thing people have really liked is not just the financial aspect of it, but also like the community aspect of it. And so there's a lot in there about how to make friends with other low-income students or how to tell your friends that, you know, you can't go out to eat because, you know, you can't afford it. Mm-hmm. Or like how to find mentors with professors who are also first gen. So we have a list of first generation low income professors in there too. And some professors have actually gone in and like added their names to it. So
that's
they're
so
making themselves
great.
A resource. Yeah. So that's been really nice, is that sense of community as well.
I scanned it quickly myself, but I was so impressed by like all the tips about jobs and internships and scholarships and all the resources that you make available to people is really so valuable.
Oh, it wasn't just me, you know, because of the nature of a crowdsourced document, like so many people contributed. I started with the outline, I wrote the introduction and like some parts of the housing or job section, but like all of it was just like the knowledge of other people, which is probably the most incredible thing. It's like not only students, but alumni, and we've had faculty and administrators go in there, but also community members, people not affiliated with the university in any way. It's great. And so there's no way of tracking how many contributors we've had, but people go in there and they add little pieces to information, or they comment on things, or they, you know, will add entire sections. Mm-hmm. And so it's been really great.
What about for you? What little tips have you discovered in there? I mean, is there the greatest, like, cheapest lunch in town or, like, stuff like that?
Yeah,
like,
there are some great happy hour specials that I've definitely taken advantage of. so that's been great.
Do you ever hear from maybe older people like myself who would say, it's so different now? Like, man, you guys got it bad. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I'm trying to compare and contrast like what students face today versus what they may have faced like in the 80s or something like that.
I appreciate people saying like you guys have it bad, because a lot of the feedback that I've gotten, especially as the news of the guide has sort of gone national, is like, well, when I was in college, I just worked through it and it was fine. Like, why can't you do it? Stop whining, you know? And so I appreciate an adult who's willing to say, like, it was so much cheaper when I was your age. You guys really are screwed. Because I'm like, yeah, you're right. We are. And I would rather have that discussion than try to convince someone that we're not whining. It's just excessively expensive, like, and totally unattainable for people who don't have the money to go to college.
It takes all the meritocracy out of it, because, you know, right. You deserve to be here and yet you can't afford it. So
right.
That's just bull.
And I think a lot of the time, the thing with this college admission scam is that it's so absurd and sensationalized that people are actually paying attention to it. But in a lot of cases, parents do this in totally legal ways. Mm-hmm. And their kids aren't dumb. They've worked really hard and gotten good scores, and they didn't have to, like, forge their essays or their applications to get into these schools. But they've had a leg up in a lot of ways. And I feel like that's the part of it that we're not really acknowledging, is like, you know, what are the legal ways and like not absurd ways that we can get these like moderately smart, really wealthy students into college and get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
The meritocracy thing begins before college. I feel like people, when they're talking about student debt, they sort of center that in this college debate about equity in higher ed, but it's really like it starts in K-12 when, like, automatically, if you can afford private school, you're getting a better education most of the time. If you go to public school and you live in a wealthy area, your school's going to be better funded, mm-hmm. because those funds come from local taxes, which are higher in your area. So poor students are automatically set up to fail, and then there are all these other resources that you can buy for your kids to help them get into mm-hmm. college that are completely
tutors
legal.
And prep,
right.
Yeah, all that stuff, test prep and everything, yeah.
So that's like, college debt is absolutely ridiculous, and like, college should be free, in my opinion, or at least very, very cheap. But I think one of the biggest crimes that we can implicate this country with is the fact that it is setting its students up to fail from the beginning, like from birth. And so I think that's also a very key component, too, is, like, who's getting into these universities, who's applying, who's qualified by virtue of, like, these standards that they've set up, and, you know, who's left out. And I don't want to generalize about low-income students, but I a lot of them that I know, and myself included, like, did not have parents hovering over us to do things for us because those parents were at work or they didn't know how to guide us through the application process or help us register for classes. And so it seems really daunting. I remember when my parents dropped me off at college, they were more scared than I was because they had just never, you know, been to a place like this before. They had never been to a university, and so it wasn't something that they could really conceptualize. Like, I wish I would have had a document like that my freshman year, which, like, people have come up to me and said, like, I wish I had that when I was in college. And it's a really great feeling to know that, like, you helped create a resource that a lot of people can benefit from in that way.
And then you've already transported it to where, Princeton or somewhere? Who else is using it?
It's been picked up by UT Austin, University of Nevada, George Washington University, University of Arizona, like places all around the country. But there are others that I just don't know about, which is fine. I didn't copyright it, and I don't want to. Yeah. So please spread the word. Keep doing that.
Well, you heard her. Start spreading the word. She's also produced a single-page document, Being Not Rich DIY, to tell fellow students how to write their own Not Rich guides. Well, thanks so much for listening. You can find more Listen In Michigan podcasts at Google Play Music, iTunes, TuneIn, and Stitcher. Search for Listen In, Michigan. You also can find episodes at michigantoday.umich.edu. Just click the podcast tab on the top of the page. Well, that's it for now. Until we meet again, go blue.